Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, our weekly unfiltered episode. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, other than the high heat here in South Carolina.
Oh, what are you hitting?
We're going to hit 99, supposedly.
Woo!
Yes.
Oh, my Lord. Okay, you had a little bit of spring.
Yeah.
You then sprang forward right into the summer. Mitha, how are you doing?
Good. We're not too far behind. We're in the upper 80s. I think it's 89 tomorrow, so not upset is about it? That.
But, you know, but I think it's going to be a little, exactly, not upset. I mean, I had bought plants like 10 days ago and they've been sitting inside my house just waiting to get out and they're finally out. So I'm happy for that. But
I channeled my inner Rabia too. I went and spent too much money getting all kinds of stuff for the backyard. Looks nice. Mm.
Does it?
Yes.
I'm excited. Yes. I got to see. I need photographic evidence and
yeah,
I want to come and check
absolutely.
It out.
We just got some planting beds. We're planning to plant like dill and vegetables and all, but we're in the drought here in South Carolina, so we're kind of waiting for some rain before we actually plant the seeds.
Yeah. Okay, so this will be our kind of spin-off podcast. Rabia Midon Colin Garden.
Exactly.
Gardening episodes. That's exciting, Colin. Dill, however, I don't think needs a lot of water. I'm not good at herbs. I don't know why, but my veggies take off. And by the way, if you're the kind of person who kill anything, tomatoes take a lot of work to kill.
Yeah, we're holding off on tomatoes. We're doing some spinach.
Okay. No, but tomatoes are easy is what I'm saying.
Oh, they're easy.
Tomatoes
okay.
Yeah. You got to work to kill those things.
Okay.
Listen, my theory is that plants want to live.
Mm-hmm.
We do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
I'm sure I would find a way. I just noticed I killed a bamboo. Another one. So
bamboos are so resilient.
You would think, but I'm stronger than they are.
I'm stronger than they are. I will kill bamboos. I'm going to take a field trip to your house, Mito. Okay,
please
I'm excited
do.
For
please
this
help,
journey,
please.
Colin. Colin, you have officially reached middle age. Welcome.
And we're doing the herbs in parts. We can put them in the homemade sourdough bread we make. So I'm definitely middle age.
Oh, hello. Wait, was this a COVID hobby that just became permanent?
No, we started about a year ago doing the homemade sourdough. It's because we love sourdough. And
we're all getting old.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
It's gone well.
Oh, that's great. That's exciting. Okay. I love a good homemade sourdough. I do not bake, but anyway. All right. So I wanted to start off with a couple of we got a bunch of reactions, especially about the Wi-Fi discussion we had last week. So and then we got a couple of emails that I want to read. The first one is kind of long, it's lengthy, but I'll see if I can either get through it quick or summarize as I go. But so you know, Colin, pay attention because this is about your story, although I have been called out for some things I said in here. So here we go. This is from Kelsey Hughes. Kelsey says, I was listening to your recent unfiltered episode. I had to write in to share my perspective. I'm a current law student who is motivated to apply to law school for a second career transition after 10 years working in public libraries, thanks in part to Undisclosed and what I learned about the law from your podcast. Thank you, Kelsey. Anyway, I usually really enjoy particularly Colin segments in the unfiltered episodes because it's always an interesting complication of the things I'm learning in law school. However, I had to write in about the most recent conversation on public Wi-Fi because I felt it was missing an important angle, especially for a podcast focused on wrongful incarceration. In my time in the public library, I work with people every single day who either, one, lacked a device to access the internet, two, lacked reliable internet access, or three, lacked the digital literacy to be able to use the internet. Poor, rural, and older communities in particular are extremely vulnerable. During COVID, for example, the city found that 40.7% of primarily Black Baltimore residents did not have home internet. Meanwhile, my in-laws who live on a farm in Western PA don't have home internet. You know what? This is tough. Well, okay, I already started it. Meanwhile, my in-laws who live on a farm in Western PA don't have home internet because they literally aren't wired to have it. That means every single thing that people without access to do has to be on public internet. That's often the public library or Starbucks, or as it was a solution in Baltimore, many other places, public-private partnerships for open Wi-Fi signals in neighborhoods. The internet is required to function in society. Most government forms aren't even available in print anymore. Very true. You can't make an appointment or submit a complaint or conduct your personal communication or get your health records without going online. I once tried to call the MVA for a disabled 9-year-old veteran who didn't have an email address to make an appointment and got an automated message that told me to go online and hung up on me. This is very, very true. And not to mention the non-essential but still important social and cultural things that happen exclusively online. Many folks know they are less secure but don't have any other option. Many more don't even understand the difference. So yes, libraries and coffee shops usually do have a disclaimer that the internet connection is public, though usually libraries try to completely wipe sessions after every use so we have nothing stored. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do more to protect rights and prevent these disparities. I was deeply concerned to hear Robbie, of all people, say that the government should be allowed to violate your privacy if you are doing something wrong. I think that was a little mischaracterization of what I said, or maybe I said it wrong, but I'll get to that. That puts the cart before the horse if the only way they know you've done something wrong is if they violate your privacy, right? Think of someone accused of a crime who can only answer their attorney's emails on public Wi-Fi. Do they not have a right to private counsel? Or the person who's researching a local No Kings protest who becomes a target of suspicion under a right-wing government? Or a woman looking up information about abortion in a state where it's illegal, whether or not she actually intends to get one, becoming the target of investigation just because of what she searched? Or, as Colin mentioned, the person who just happens to Google the wrong thing at the wrong time and is suddenly implicated in a crime because the government can do broad sweeps of data with little justification, kind of like using someone's imprecise cell phone location data to conveniently match them to a crime. The government has no other proof they committed. Noted. I see you, Kelsey. Okay. I understand the crime at issue in the podcast was horrifying and gross, and there's also some nuance to it being a private business as compared to a public resource like the library. But focusing only on the crime committed and not the potential implications of the underlying law is what has led to the court to chip away consistently at our rights to privacy. The fact that occasionally a bad guy is caught, and those are usually the cases that make it up to higher courts, masks all the times the police have dug deep in someone's personal information, violated their privacy, and found nothing. The internet is a persistent and consistent part of our daily life, whether or not we actively choose to participate. It should not be on the individual to protect themselves. All right. Finally, thought I'd share two resources with you. First, the Library Freedom Project, which trains library staff to protect people's digital privacy in the library. There's also a really wonderful YA book called Little Brother by Cory Doctorow that actually does an amazing job explaining both the technical details and the privacy implications of broad digital surveillance. It's a bit older now, but still resonates and really opened my eyes when I read it. Highly recommend, and the author even makes it free online. Sorry for the excessively long email. Your conversation just happened to hit precisely at the intersection of my three interests. Appreciate you and all the work you do. So I'm going to first ask Colin your thoughts.
Yeah, first of all, thanks for the feedback. And second, I don't remember exactly what I read from the Supreme Court of Oregon opinion, but I think I read this one quote, which was, they said, it's a necessary concession to modern life that to use the internet, one must access it through channels controlled by others, which makes one's browsing activity potentially viewable by third parties. That does not change the societal norm that a person's internet searches and browsing activities are reasonably considered to be private. And I think that's where I landed, which is, if I'm using the Wi-Fi network at a library or a fast food restaurant, the Fourth Amendment should apply. I should have a right to privacy. And so I completely agree with everything what was said about people lacking access to reliable internet and having to use these Wi-Fi networks. And I think we had some back and forth, but I think all three of us in the end agreed that there should be a right to privacy here. So I think I'm largely on the same page.
Right. I think where we landed, where I certainly landed, was that when you are using a public space, right, or you are at a business can refuse service if you're not compliant, you're not wearing shoes, they can refuse service. Like they, and even in public spaces, like we have certain rights in public spaces or in private, in our homes that we do not have in public spaces. Like this is kind of an expectation that should be understood, I feel like, by anybody using the any kind of public resource, you know. And when you go in, I mean, I'll give you an example. Forget the internet. If I am being charged with a crime and the state thinks that maybe they might find some evidence in my history of the library books I have checked out, they can subpoena that stuff. And then a judge has to decide whether or not that's going to be excluded or allowed, depending on whether it falls within like what is right, like within the Fourth Amendment or not. And at the end of the day, if you access, it's not about what should happen. It's about kind of like how the world works, right? And also operationally, it's not so much that, I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't mass surveillance going on so that law enforcement can look for reasons to come after you. I grew up legally in the post 9/11 era. That was happening all the time. It was a big issue for our community, right? Like, we had to teach each other to be careful about our stupidest internet searches online. Their entire cases around kids from the Muslim community who went to play paintball like 3 years after 9/11, and they were arrested because they were charged with, oh, they were practicing jihad by playing paintball. We stopped playing paintball. I get it, Kelsey. What I'm saying is that, you know, I don't know if, like, you know, there's in states where, for example, abortion is outlawed, if they're going to be looking for this just in general, like, can, what would they have to do? They'd have to have the library turn over all the records so then they can go through the records to find anybody who's doing these kinds of searches, right? But at the end of the day, this is what happens in a court of law every single day. Lawyers battle it out about what has to, what can be, you know, introduced and what has to be excluded under the law. And so while I agree, we always err on the side of a person's privacy, at the end of the day, if you are already being charged criminally for something, that opens the door for investigators to look at anything that they can use as evidence. I don't care if it's your cell phone records. I don't care if it's your medical history. I don't care. They can try to access. That's their job. They're going to try to access every aspect of your life. They're going to try to figure out every move you have made in whatever recent history to try to build their case against you. That's literally how this works. So I don't know if we land in a different place, but maybe I'm just hearing something. Like, maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying versus what we're saying.
Well, it's also, I mean, the issue in the case was, is a warrant required, right? That's not to say the police can't get the warrant. Here, there was no warrant when they were working with A&W to get the Wi-Fi records. And so the conclusion was there's a right to privacy, and they'd have to go through the warrant process if they wanted to access.
So here's my question, Colin. Was a warrant, would the warrant have to be served on the guy using the computer or the people who owned the internet?
It would be served on A&W, on the fast food establishment.
Now, if this entity is willing to turn this shit over without a warrant, they would have turned it over with a warrant. Right? Like, at the end of the day, like, it's their utility that somebody else is using. So the so that's why I'm like, I don't know if that level of right to privacy, like, make, like, in the world that we live in, it doesn't work. It just, it's not a thing. Right? They would, so again, I think they would have cooperated anyways, right?
The question is whether the judge would have approved the warrant based upon the evidence. Yeah. A&W would have, I'm sure, played ball, but whether the judge would have found enough to grant the warrant is another question.
Yeah. Well, that's, that is another question. I think, what about you, Mitha? What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, I think, again, that we're all on the same page. And in this case, I think the other part of it was what he was searching and looking at, right? I think that's what we're like, do whatever you need to do, just, you know, so that he gets caught because of what he was doing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not opposed to you building a case against somebody who is perhaps, you know, a danger to children. And in this case, it seems demonstrably so. You know, it's his lawyer's job to defend him. And like, a lot of these things have to be hashed out in front of a judge. So, I mean, I understand, like, I understand where you land on this, Kelsey. I just think that those disclaimers and disclosures are there at the beginning of every time you access public Wi-Fi for a reason. It's because we don't have that expectation of privacy. We just don't. Now, that would take like some legal changes and legislative changes and all that kind of stuff. But until then, that's just where we are. All right. I got another email on the same issue from Katya. Katya says, love the show. I'm a day one listener. I'm also a software engineer. Wanted to comment on the latest episode about right to privacy on public Wi-Fi and have a thought that might resonate with you. One of the main reasons we need a right to privacy is because human rights are being destroyed every day. Imagine if a domestic abuse victim in Texas becomes pregnant by her abuser and goes to public Wi-Fi to look up an abortion. Same example. Imagine an undocumented immigrant, or as now happens, a documented immigrant using public Wi-Fi to look up information about their next visa appointment. There are so many crimes that should not be crimes. These scenarios require a right to privacy, or we may have no rights at all. Privacy in the technical sector often means sacrificing finding bad guys for protecting people suffering harm. Consider a service like Telegram being used both by Iranian dissidents and U.S. neo-Nazis. It's a complicated issue with no easy answers, but I believe that we should always err on the side of privacy. Hopefully this perspective makes sense. It's been challenging work to work in the tech industry lately, but fighting for the security and privacy of human internet users, of internet users is one thing that keeps me going. Thanks for doing what you do. I agree 100% with everything you
said. Let's get her to law school as well, because that's a really great statement of the competing interests there and some nice examples to include in there. So I appreciate both those comments.
By the way, you know, hearkening back to the post 9/11 stuff that I was talking about, there was mass surveillance, that a lot of it was kind of warrantless. However, the majority of it was with warrants. It's not that, I mean, you just got to find the right judge to sign off on what you want. They can get it. It's not that big of a hill to climb. All right, I feel like I've been talking already for 3 hours, so I'm going to popcorn it off to you, Colin. Why don't you go next? What story do you have for us this week?
Yeah, my story, breaking news in Maryland, legislation passed and has now gone to Governor Wes Moore, and this is right in my field of evidence law. And it's something I've been blogging and writing about for over a decade, and that is the prosecution's use of rap lyrics in criminal trials. And so this legislation in Maryland, it is called the PACE Act, Protecting Artists' Creative Expression. And it says that prosecutors can't use rap lyrics or any lyrics written by a criminal defendant unless four things can be proven. One, the probative value of the creative expression outweighs its prejudicial effect. That's an inversion of the usual balancing test for evidence, which says usually evidence is admissible unless its probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. Then we have these two conjoining elements. Prosecution has to prove there's a close temporal and factual nexus between the creative expression and the alleged offense, and the creative expression is relevant to a disputed issue of fact. Then the final element is the one where I think there might be too much discretion in terms of the judge, which is prosecution has to prove the defendant or respondent intended the creative expression to be literal rather than figurative or fictional, or if the creative expression is derivative, defendant intended to adopt the literal meaning of the creative expression as their own. Okay, and so what's a case where this use of rap lyrics has existed in the past, and how would this act likely change it in Maryland? This is a case out of the Fourth Circuit, which is the federal judicial circuit that covers both Maryland as well as North Carolina and South Carolina. There was an individual in Western North Carolina, Kenneth Watkins, and he was charged with conspiracy to possess controlled substance with intent to distribute. During the defense case, they called his wife. His wife testified, "Both my husband and I are devout Muslims. My husband is a good father. He has a strong work ethic." She described him as into his religion, said it's not in his character to commit crimes. On cross-examination, this defendant had written rap lyrics, and there were questions about rap lyrics. He wrote one song called "Don't Do It." "They've got more money than all of them. We got more guns than all of them." And then later, there was another lyric seeming to allude to drugs on a song he wrote called "Truckloads." And what the Fourth Circuit found was because he had introduced evidence of his good character, these rap lyrics were admissible to show a different side of his character and illicit behavior. And this is a big issue that has split courts across the country. And so, as anyone who's read my blog knows, I'm strongly against the use of rap lyrics at criminal trials. My two questions are, one, are you two against, or is it case by case in terms of rap lyrics at a trial? And then two, what do we think about a legislature telling courts what evidence can and can't come in as opposed to judges deciding that?
Okay, first of all, Colin, is your opposition specifically to the use of rap lyrics, but let's say a Katy Perry song type of thing, would, like pop lyrics would be okay, country lyrics would be okay? Can you tell
and it's
me
a
why?
Great question, which is, you know, people aren't introducing Johnny Cash, Folsom County Blues into evidence. If Stephen King's on trial, his horror books aren't coming to evidence. And so I'm across the board.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that? If Stephen King is on trial for something that he, a crime that looks something like exactly that he wrote about in a book, we've come across cases like this. Why wouldn't it be introduced as evidence?
It could. Realistically, I've done a good deal of research on this. By far, the vast majority of cases, these are rap lyrics. They're not introducing country lyrics, rock lyrics, punk lyrics. It's not to say they couldn't. I think the ban should apply across the board. It's just this is something we see selectively used against particular defendants in a particular genre of music.
Right. Okay, but this legislation is not just for rap lyrics.
No, it would cover any artistic expression.
And it could be a painting. It could be a book. It could be anything.
Right.
Interesting. Well, okay. I like kind of, it's interesting that this got to legislation. I did not know about this, but I think the framework makes sense in terms of having a, you know, is it, right, if I write a murder mystery and, I don't know, 5 years later, like my spouse mysteriously dies, right? Like, is there any kind of factual nexus between like the what actually happened in the real world to what happened in my book type of thing versus it just happened, the facts don't match, right? I think that helps create some padding around the use of it. But I guess it's just, I don't know. I'm like, you know, I feel like it's like any other, it's almost like any other communication, right? Like, artistic expression is a communication. So what about like a diary entry that in which I write a poem about something, right? Like, and I write a poem describing a crime that I committed or a crime that I'm going to commit or something, and that's used as evidence. I feel like that's fair game, like for the state to try to bring it in, whether or not they can get it in.
And that gets that last element, which is, can they prove it was literal as opposed to figurative or fictional? And that's what judges are going to have to decide in these cases. Do we think that diary entry is just a fictional poem, or is it describing something you actually did?
I mean, I guess my question, I feel like any time rap lyrics or any kind of creative expression maybe is being introduced in front of a judge, isn't a judge making a determination based on these kinds of things anyways? Don't these standards kind of exist anyways, right? Like that's the basis to like kind of keep it out.
Yeah, I mean, they have to decide, is this part of the defendant's character, right? That was in this Fourth Circuit case I noted. Mm-hmm. They have to decide, are these rap lyrics reflective of a character towards illicit behavior and drug running or drug use? This sort of gives a framework where here's how you balance probative value and unfair prejudice.
Right.
Is this just general posturing in a song, which of course we're all familiar with, or is it actually describing their character and their conduct?
Mm. Ethel, what do you think?
I think across the board, because it is creative expression, it should not be allowed. Like, I mean, I think you should be able to sing and rap about whatever you want and it not be taken literally. But I think it absolutely makes sense to have exceptions where on a case-by-case basis, depending on what, you know, the situation is and what the case is about, if something supports, you know, this person's character, even if it is a rap lyric, then that should be able to be introduced. Because I'm thinking about a case out of New York, I think, where it was an acid attack, but two people just recently were caught because one of the guys is like a wannabe rapper. And in his lyrics, he wrote something about throwing acid or something, something, something. So that's how they even got to him. And he's been charged. And they just recently found a second accomplice as part of that. So that just kind of makes...
I mean, it doesn't feel like it should be enough to convict him. I mean, right? But I guess... I don't know if it could be.
In that case, I don't know if it's just that, but I know that's how they kind of got to him. So, you know, but again, across the board, anybody that writes a song, regardless of what the lyrics is, like, no, you shouldn't automatically be assumed that you mean everything literally.
Yeah, I mean, have you all listened to death metal? I mean... What about the case that artist David? That's what like came to me when you brought this up, right? Are you familiar? You're familiar with that, right?
The one the young woman was found in the car.
The young girl, 14-year-old girl named Celeste Rivas Hernandez was found in the trunk of this artist's car that car was in a tow yard. Her body is decomposed. She had been missing for a long time. He clearly was grooming her. I mean, I think it's already been established that he had like a sexual relationship with this child. He goes by the name David, as you know, anyhow, but his name is David Anthony Burke. He is now the target of how can he be just the target and not charged yet? But he hasn't been charged yet. But yeah, and apparently he wrote an entire song about her and about harming a girl named Celeste. And so I don't know if it's a rap song or not. I don't know what kind of music he does, but would that not be fair game, you think?
I think that's the nexus portion of the bill.
Right.
There has to be a close temporal and factual nexus between the creative expression and the alleged offense. So I think there's a big difference between, you know, someone speaking about drugs generally in rap lyrics and someone talking about a specific person who was found in the trunk of this car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, if you've written a rap lyric at any point in your life, you talk about, and you're talking about like a, I don't know, a drive-by or a gangbang or something, and then later you maybe might be involved in something like that, even though at the time you wrote it, it wasn't like an indication of intention, or even if you did it, wrote it late. Like, I feel like even a nexus like that would hold up, like, in court.
And I think this we'll have to see in Maryland cases going forward is how close of a nexus, how particular this needs to be as opposed to general boasting or speaking about a community you grew up in or what you saw.
Was there a particular case that this legislation kind of sprang out of?
I'm sure there have been cases in Maryland where this came up. I'm not sure particularly, but I'm sure it's a bunch of cases where rap lyrics came in.
Hopefully it's not the end of the rap industry.
The end of the rap industry.
That would be awful. That'll be the end of
again, I direct your attention towards death metal, but we know it's a whole different population of folks in that genre, so that's probably what it is. All right, Mitha, what do you got for this week?
So I was going to cover something different, but I'm staying on brand with my usual theme. I couldn't get this out of my head, so I had to. This is a story that actually came out last week, and it takes place in eastern France, a town called Hagenbach. So neighbors reported hearing sounds of a child from a van parked in a common area of a neighborhood, a block where there's a bunch of flats. So police came out to check it out, and they found a 9-year-old boy inside. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
Okay. He was naked, lying in the fetal position under a blanket on a pile of trash. There was also excrement nearby. He was malnourished, unable to walk. Police brought in the boy's father for questioning, and the father confirmed he's the one who kept the boy in the van to, quote-unquote, protect him. From what exactly? From his partner, who, quote, wanted to put him in a psychiatric care, unquote. Now, according to the prosecutor, there's no medical record at all that the boy had any problems. He had good grades in school. But the boy, when speaking to the investigators, said that he had big difficulties with his father's partner and that he felt that he agreed that, you know, his father had no choice but to lock him up in the van. Now, the boy also said that his father would bring him food twice a day, bottles of water. He would then urinate in those empty water bottles and defecate in trash bags. Oh, and the reason that he was unable to walk when the police rescued him out of that van was because he had been in there just sitting and lying down for so long that his muscles atrophied. Sure, he ate food, drank water, but then he was literally next to his trash and excrement. He hadn't showered at all.
How long had he been there?
I was just going to ask, do you want to guess how long he had been there?
Have to be like a month, I would think.
Since November 2024.
Oh my God.
What?
November 2024?
2024, when he was just 7 years old at the time.
Oh my God.
A year and a half in a van.
Burn that man at the stake. You don't have to finish the story. Just burn him at the stake.
I mean, this is why I had to talk about it, because it's just, anyways, Let me continue. So, of course, people noticed that the boy wasn't around, and anytime they asked about him, the parents would say he's in a facility for care. His school was told that he transferred to another school. And the father has been charged with kidnapping, among other things, and he's in custody right now. His partner, who, is the reason behind all this supposedly happening, she denied knowing that the boy was even in the van the whole time. So I guess she's assuming, oh yeah, he was at a facility. We'll see if that's actually true. But she's also been charged with some offenses, including failure to help a minor in danger. And she's been released under judicial supervision. Now, they also have two other children, a 10 and 12-year-old, who have been in the home. But of course, they've been temporarily placed in social services care while the investigation continues on. Now, again, we obviously hear tragic stories on a daily basis, but like I said, this one just stayed with me because it's like there are so many other ways that this could have been handled that didn't involve locking a child up for a year and a half to protect him. And, I just have so many questions. Like, did no one ever see the father as he went to visit the van, twice a day? Was he going in the middle of the night? Did he move the van and then give his son food? Like, it's like that child was in
Where's
solitary.
the mother?
Well, I don't know. There's no information about the mother
Okay.
because the partner is not the mother. So yeah, I don't know. And again, this just kind of broke out last week, so there's not that much information besides what I've
I
shared.
mean, look, the idea that they had no other choice, yeah, break up with her maybe,
Right.
but I don't, I mean, like, and this is not that complicated. No, this, I mean, like, there's, this is a very, I don't think there's any real moral or legal dilemma here. I think this is a clear case of child abuse and neglect, and it's horrifying. And I'm just imagining a child being locked in a car day and night, just at night
Right.
alone, just being alone.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it makes me wonder whether there's a mental health issue with the father, because obviously, as Rabia notes, this is horrendous, and it seems open and shut in terms of this person needing to be sanctioned and seriously, but you have to think there's some type of mental health issue going on for this to have been going on for 18 months
Yeah.
or so.
And if, and nobody reported it all this time, nobody noticed this all this time.
No, I
Did,
mean, it,
we're talking about the
apparently,
kind of van that, like, he's in the back where there's no windows. Is that
I
what we're
don't
talking
know.
about? We don't know.
There's no image of the van, so I don't know if we're talking about a minivan. I don't know if it's a utility type truck van situation. I don't know. And let's say even if he's periodically taking the trash, like, are you doing this at night when nobody's watching you? But also, if we're talking about every single day, potentially for a year and a half, nobody saw you. That's why I'm wondering, did you,
Yeah.
was he moving the van and going somewhere else and then interacting or what? Because really that child was in solitary confinement for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And the boy is at the hospital right now, obviously receiving care. So, we'll see what comes of the investigation. Obviously, they're going to talk to the other two children. So of the three children, two of the children are his and then the other one is hers. So that's kind of the joint family situation. So,
Got it. And
the other children also didn't report that our brother is missing.
well, again, they were, whoever asked about him were told he went to this care facility because he has issues. And the
Oh,
school was
okay.
told he's at another school. There are reports of like some other neighbors at some point, over this time period reporting that they heard sounds coming out of the van. But he apparently said like, oh, it's just a cat nearby or something. And so that's how they just kind of had their doubts, but I don't know. And so again, part of this investigation is them talking to all the neighbors around, family, friends. Did anybody else have a clue and not say anything, or was everybody in the dark the whole time? And this is solely
Well,
what the father has done. Or is the partner involved and she's just saying, I had no idea.
I mean, what I wonder too is we hear all these stories about children dying in hot cars, and I mean, France in the summer, you'd have to imagine, gets pretty hot. How did this kid survive?
Yeah, I don't know, but I'll be following this case.
Yeah.
I feel like not a month goes by in which we don't hear something similar. Like, children, some child locked in a barn, a child held in a basement for a year. Like, we hear this all of the time. It is, I don't, wasn't there a story recently? Actually, it was like about a year ago, where this family, this husband and wife, had been fostering black children. They were a white couple, and kept them out, like in a shed, like almost kind of like treating them like they were slaves that they owned.
It's sickening. That's awful. There is a case of a mother who was just, I think, sentenced to death for, her stepdaughter died because she was malnourished. The woman made food all day, every day for her children, and the girl was in her bedroom. She just never received any of it.
Oh, my God.
What is wrong with these people?
I don't know. That's horrific.
But yeah, so...
Burn them all at the stake.
Seriously.
I don't need a trial. Just burn them at the stake. It's... What's a... Oh, my God. It's been so long since I've been to law school. The thing speaks for itself. What's the Latin?
Res ipsa loquitur.
There, thank you. That it. That, there you go. That's all I need to know. So I want to talk about a case that it's, you know, like it's a pretty high profile case. But what's interesting is kind of the legal turn it's taken. And a lot of legal commentators are saying it's significant for the verdicts that have been reached. And that's the Matthew Perry case. Now, obviously, a lot of us know who Matthew Perry was as an actor. He was, you know, Chandler Bing on Friends. And that ran like, I don't know, 10, 15 years. He was a household name. In 2022, he wrote a book called Friends, Lovers, and the Big Terrible Thing. And it was a memoir. And he really opened up about his lifelong fight with crippling addiction to alcohol and opioids. He also did a lot of media around this. I remember at the time, his addiction was so terrible. At one point, he weighed like around 125 pounds. And he was taking 55 Vicodin pills a day. He tried 15 different rehab programs. He spent $7 million trying to get sober. A year after his book came out, on October 28, 2023, Perry was found face down in a heated pool at his home in Los Angeles. He was only 54. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Now, it was one of those cases where we've seen this a lot of times, where certain celebrities, you hear young, sudden death, and you're... Mm-hmm. It's sad, but you're not shocked by it. You're like, well, I mean, like, you know, given the history here. But then his toxicology report came out in December 2023, and his cause of death was acute ketamine overdose. Now, he had been using ketamine infusion therapy to treat his depression. And this is a legitimate doctor-supervised medical treatment. But what happened was, when they did the autopsy report, they found out that the ketamine in his system was not the ketamine that would have been used in his medical treatments. So the level that was found, it was the kind used in like surgical anesthesia. It was way beyond what would be given in a therapeutic dose. And they're like, okay, where is he getting this ketamine that he was not getting in the medical treatment? A few months later, the LAPD, they open a criminal investigation, and they uncover an entire team of people who were part of this kind of supply chain, a doctor, a middleman, drug dealer, and Perry's own personal assistant. So there's five people who were charged in his death. Dr. Mark Chavez, who's a licensed physician who was initially supplying Perry with ketamine. He began supplying it to him illegally outside of his therapy dose in cash. Then another doctor, Dr. Salvador Plasencia, who was, again, oversupplying Perry. He even texted him at one point saying, how much will this, texted an associate asking, how much will this moron pay? And he referred to Perry as his patient in his communications, but he was just supplying him with kind of unregulated doses, just like whatever he wanted. Then there was a middleman, Eric Fleming, who kind of connected a lot of these people. And then there's this woman known locally as the ketamine queen, Jasveen Sangha. She ran a full drug operation out of her apartment in North Hollywood. She stockpiled and she sold ketamine, and she sold 51 vials to Perry's assistant and Just as a bonus, she threw in ketamine-infused lollipops. And then there was his assistant, Kenneth Iwamasa. It was his live-in personal assistant. He was the one who was physically injecting Perry with the ketamine, sometimes many, many times a day. All right. 6 months or a few, yeah, 4 months after they opened the investigation, they, Sanga and Dr. Plasencia get arrested. All five are eventually charged with federal crimes, including conspiracy to distribute ketamine causing death. And one by one, they plead guilty. Dr. Chavez gets 3 years supervised release and 8 months home confinement. Dr. Plasencia pleads guilty, sentenced to 30 months in prison, surrendering his medical license. Eric Fleming, the middleman, his sentencing is coming up in a couple weeks, but he faces up to 25 years. Kenneth Iwamasa, the personal assistant, his sentencing is also coming up April 22nd, and he faces up to 15 years. And finally, Jasveen Sangha, the ketamine queen, is the last person to plead guilty, and she was just sentenced. She faced up to 65 years in prison. She wrote a letter to the court. She said her guilt was like, quote, a jacket she can't take off. She begged for forgiveness, and she got 15 years in federal prison. Okay. So legally, the case is being called kind of a landmark moment because the first time that a drug dealer has been federally prosecuted and sentenced in connection with a celebrity overdose death. Now, what a lot of people don't know, and I didn't know this until recently, is that Keith Morrison was Matthew Perry's stepfather. Mm-hmm. He raised Matthew Perry, and he has been very kind of vocal since his death about like this issue and been an advocate to protect folks from people like this who are taking advantage of people with addiction. So here's the thing. At the end of the day, right now, it's about like the legal questions here are like, number one, first of all, the doctors are being treated like drug dealers and they're being prosecuted as such. It's very, very rare because doctors have always been kind of shielded by the argument that they're treating a patient, that there's like certain expectations of like privacy, confidentiality, even when the treatment in the past has been like reckless or illegal, like because they're treating a patient, they've been shielded from this kind of prosecution. Then the fact that the street level dealer is federally charged with causing a death. It wasn't just simple drug distribution. She's charged with distribution resulting in death, which could have gotten her life in prison. Even though the charge has existed, it's almost never been applied outside of opioid cases and never against a ketamine dealer, apparently. And prosecutors said that they used her case to send an explicit message stating in court that anyone in the drug business who, quote, gambles with other people's lives will now be held accountable. There's also the issue that, you know, ketamine is the substance at the center of this case, and it's exploded, you know, in the market recently as legal therapy for depression, which makes the line between legitimate medical use and like an illegal supply kind of murky. He was a genuine ketamine therapy patient, but obviously if he is a lifelong addict, then there's a very slippery slope around him using any kind of controlled substance, right? So the question is the FDA and the DEA going to tighten regulations around how ketamine is prescribed and distributed? Which this FDA perhaps not. you know, what do you guys think about? I mean, look, think this is like not the first. I mean, there's so many celebrity overdoses that exist, like, you know, just in our own lives. Heath Ledger, Prince, Mac Miller. I mean, like, there's, you know, nobody's ever been criminally charged with supplying the drugs there. But this might be a signal that federal prosecutors are willing to go upstream and pursue like the full network, every person in the supply chain. And so there are legal analysts saying that this is kind of a turning point. Thoughts?
I mean, I think it's great. I think it's great because it's about time. You know, how many people, not just celebrities, how many people have to die before somebody cares and actually holds this, in this case, this team of people responsible? Celebrities have money, so you're exploiting their money. Many of them may have addiction, so you're also exploiting that factor, and you're just kind of, you're just raking in the money and you're getting what you want, but you're putting their lives at risk knowingly, right? In this case, especially if she was giving him an amount that was not safe for his therapeutic treatment. So, I mean, I think it's great. It's about time is what I would say about that.
Yeah, and so this is something I teach in my class where I think Mithil speaks to the positive side, but there's also a cause for concern, which is we're discussing a federal case and a high-profile case. Many states have recently enacted these drug-induced homicide laws. And the design is something like the Matthew Perry case or someone selling drugs to a high school student who overdoses and dies, but a lot of them are being used to prosecute a friend who buys some cocaine or some other drug, and they share it with their friend who overdoses and dies. And this person who's not a drug dealer, they've just bought some drugs for themselves and a friend, and they're being prosecuted under the law. And so I think there is some good to it. And I think the Matthew Perry case is a good illustration of the type of case where you would want to see this type of law in effect. I just think we need to have a good dose of caution regarding the breadth of some of these statutes and the breadth of cases in which it's being applied for some prosecutions.
I mean, and you know, I imagine, I don't know, I guess like, you know, when it comes to stuff like this, like you have to imagine like what, as you said, Colin, what could be a misapplication of like what seems to be an understandable principle. You know, alcoholism is one of the greatest, like one of the, in terms of like, you know, like how more frequent it is as an addiction than many other addictions. So if you have somebody who is an alcoholic and you have somebody who is always picking up alcohol for them, or they have somebody, you know, they have a business they're always buying from. Like it almost goes back to that question of the bartender who's serving too many drinks to the drunk person right there. But it's a little different because that's like right in front of you. You're seeing maybe there could be immediate danger if they walk out. But what about the person who's in their house and they just keep ordering these bottles and bottles and bottles and bottles, or somebody's picking it up for them? And I don't know. I mean, like, would it extend to something like, could this be extended to something like alcohol, which kills a lot more people than a lot of these other drugs combined? No,
I
because
doubt it.
culturally that's acceptable,
It's seen
right?
differently. I mean, we have these old dram shop laws that we teach in law
Yeah.
school as a historical, principle. But
Right,
yeah,
right.
you're right. The drugs are seen very differently than alcohol.
Yeah, even though it kills more people. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I feel a little conflicted about this, I think. Because I also think about, like, remember the story I talked about where the guy, that billionaire who is like, I can afford to have 100 kids if I want, right? Like, I can do that with my money. And was Matthew Perry well enough to make those decisions? Probably not. But was he well within his right as an adult with his own money to make the decisions? Probably yes.
Yeah, but the professionals, the doctors, and the ketamine queen,
The
I
doctors,
mean,
yes. The doctors I get, right?
even if
Like
he wasn't in the right mind, right?
yeah.
The doctors have a duty of care. If that's
Like with
his,
Dr. Conrad Murray and the propofol with Michael Jackson as an example, right?
There's a duty of care. There's your own kind of like professional ethics. There's, you know, understanding the how this works. I mean, how does, for example, the ketamine queen, how does she know what's happening in his house? Maybe he's sharing that ketamine with six other people in his house. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm a little bit conflicted. On principle, yes, obviously. Like, we, you know, like, get it, clean it up. But then, like, balancing that with what is kind of a, now, here's the thing. Like, yeah, what we do need, obviously, is better regulation around who can get these drugs and who can supply these drugs, right? Like, this was being done in a way that was not regulated and illegal. I think that's fair. I think the death charge is what I think might be a step too far for me. I don't know. Something about it's not sitting right for me. Not with the doctors, but with the ketamine queen herself. And it's not because she's brown. I don't care about that. Doing our community proud. Thank you, ketamine queen. All right, that's all I got. I'm sure that many of these stories that we talked about are gonna again generate great emails and communication. I actually love it. Keep it coming. You make us think about perspectives that we don't have, and we appreciate it. Okay, well, thank you guys so much, and thank you guys for tuning in. We will see you, I don't know, in a week, I guess.
See you later.
All right. Have a good week.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer three simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered one or two. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with three different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being a dollar, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.